Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonstories.org.
Okay, so let me get... I'd like to make a segue here maybe into for to include Jay,
yes,
who
yes,
hopefully is not feeling too neglected here. But I definitely want to get back to, again, some of the Mormonisms about mental health and some of the things that maybe, you know, either were said to you or some of the things that even you maybe said to yourself as far as coping with mental health illness. And so let's get back to that. But Jay, hi.
Hi.
Let me get back to you. Why don't we start, Jay, with kind of you're giving your a little introduction about kind of yourself and jumping right into what this was like, because if we go back into your childhood, obviously from age six on, you were very much dealing with this, and it sounds like your mother probably dealt with these kinds of issues all throughout your adolescence. And
As a side note, I hope that I can, one of my goals is to try to help those who might not understand and why they can't see it. My goal is to sort of, I hope, help them at least understand how I came to be able to see it and came to understand what is seems to not be that easily understood by those who haven't experienced it.
Right.
So I hope that gets across somewhere in my blabberings here.
Yes, yes. And we definitely, and I'll, you know, I think that we'll probably close the podcast with maybe some pieces of advice that both of you would have. But yeah, so go ahead and get started.
Okay, so background, let's see. So I was obviously born and raised in the church, as it were, born in Salt Lake. I think my experience in life, perhaps, and particularly religiously, is best framed as a sort of unleashing of an analytical mind, so to speak. As you could probably tell from my mom, I think I inherited a lot of the traits of, you know, analyzing and a lot of worrying and things like that, and that's sort of what happens. Anyway, so as my mom mentioned, pioneer stock, sort of both sides of the family. I don't know, sixth or seventh generation Mormon, somewhere in there. Anson Call was an ancestor. Brigham Young was an ancestor. I don't recall ever being real pressured to do church or to do anything in particular. Like, I don't recall my parents pushing me to do well in school or to enroll in sports. A lot of these things just came for me fairly naturally. I always just did well in school, and church was always very important to me. I played a lot of sports when I was young, a lot of basketball, and that sort of went all the way through high school. As far as church was concerned, my dad was a finance clerk when I was real young, and obviously we've heard from mom. She was the Stake Young Women's President, and among other callings, but that's the one I remember most. I did scouting, earned my faith in God when that was something they did, Gospel in Action, did earned Eagle Scout eventually. When I was a teenager, the gospel became really serious for me. I always took it very seriously. Not, like I said, without my parents pushing. I don't recall ever being even really asked to go to church. In fact, I remember many times I would wake up and my mom would be like, you know, you don't have to go. And I just went. I just always went.
Interesting how,
yeah.
You know, he or she grew up in a home where she was forced to go and hated it, and
yep.
And you're kind of allowed your own thing and even given permission not to go, and you're like, I'm gonna be there.
Yep, I don't know why it was so important to me, but it was. I had a very influential friend, and who became a kind of counselor for me, and interestingly enough, he ended up becoming a social worker. So I think there was some of that influence. I always had good friends, good LDS friends who, you know, it just was never really a thought in my head to do anything other than what was expected of me in the church. I knew I wanted to go on a mission real young. It was always very important to me. In fact, I remember when I came home from my mission, I didn't know what to do because my whole life had been built up to that point on this concept of going on a mission. That was, I thought life ended after mission.
Now what?
Now what do I do? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I didn't question a lot of things, but I had some questions, and I often, like I said, took questions to friends, not just about church or anything, but questions in general about my mom, about things I was dealing with, and like I said, he was a sort of counselor for me. You know, I remember my parents, I don't know if they pushed or suggested or what it was, but I remember there was some mention that I ought to go see a counselor of some kind, and that was never an option for me. I refused that from the get-go.
Wait, I need to interrupt just a second here. We did take you and Joshua to be evaluated with us as a family, and then you two talked to the therapist alone because they felt like that was very important to make sure that you were okay. So there was that. I'm sorry, now I'll back out.
And this was at what age? I'm wanting to know.
I'm thinking probably maybe like 13 and what, Josh is 5 and 8?
Okay.
8 and 13 maybe.
So it's entirely possible that I blocked that out. I don't know. In any case, that must have been the only time, because I don't recall ever going.
And these are your feelings as an adolescent. You're saying that,
yeah,
that counseling was out of the question.
Yeah, I very much fell into the stigma and the stereotype that it was a choice, that my mom was a victim, that she was doing all this to get attention, and that the only real impact on me was that it made my life really inconvenient. That's a horrible thing to say, I know, but that's what I was as a selfish teenager.
Hmm.
So anyway, I sort of want to emphasize that I took church and I took those kinds of things really seriously, which I think is what largely shaped how I saw everything. I read a lot of church books. I read my scriptures every night, like starting from age 14 or something. I was just very diligent about that kind of thing.
So are you implying then that this kind of hardcore line of accepting everything in the church is what made you less empathetic to your mother's situation?
I don't want to suggest that, because I do think there was a cultural element at the time. Whether or not that stemmed directly from the church or Utah culture or American culture, I'm not exactly sure where it all ties together.
Right.
But I definitely had that idea, and I know that some of that was definitely because of the theology I espoused. Now, perhaps my theology wasn't very well suited in what we now consider to be Mormon doctrine, but it was what it was. It was how I viewed the world. It was how my friend, I think, viewed the world, since he and I counseled together. And as my mom has said, I think that view was espoused by other people in our ward and whatnot. So,
yeah, and taking into account, too, that the developmental stage of adolescence is very black and white, very tuned to hypocrisy, very... And then also, I'm sure your mother wasn't explaining to you in great detail what we've spent talking about, you know, the last... hour, two hours, whatever, as far as the trauma that she had experienced and all that.
So
you didn't have that insight.
I didn't even, I don't think I knew anything about the sexual abuse until I was a teenager. I the first recollection I have of it really impacting me and knowing that, you know, cognitively knowing that that was something that happened was probably 15 or 16. Maybe it was told to me earlier, but I don't remember. But that's the first recollection I have of really understanding that. Right. So I think I had a fairly self-righteous attitude when I was that age. You know, I had a very black and white worldview. And like I said, I did read a lot of church books. So I read a lot about compassion. I read a lot of books by general authorities. I read history books. I was a good kid. I my mom talked a little bit about curfews and things like that. I don't recall really ever having much of a curfew, at least not one that I couldn't just call and say, I'm going to be late. My parents trusted me. I don't think I ever did anything to really betray their trust. My friends, I kind of want to emphasize that my friends were really an anchor for me, not just this one close friend, but in high school I developed a close-knit circle of LDS friends, and they became a real support for me. I had a lot of spiritual experiences with them. They all got called to be on seminary council, you know, senior year of high school, which I didn't, but that's another story. But anyway.
We can do a podcast on that later.
Yeah. So
the trauma of that.
The trauma of not getting called to seminary council. It seemed traumatic at the time.
I'm sure.
Anyways. So after high school, got a job at the church distribution center after I graduated, and I had that job until I went on my mission in December of 99. I went, got called to Russia, so served in Siberia.
Wow.
I had a great mission.
Mm-hmm.
I grew a lot there. I think that's where the beginning seeds of trying to repair relationship with my mom sort of took root. So I have this sort of intro divided up into sections, and you know, later on is this section where I talk about sort of the relationship with my mom, but that's where those seeds were planted. I was very, very obedient as a missionary, to the point of probably being ridiculous. I'm sure my companions couldn't stand me. After three companions, I started to sort of get the vision that, you know, perhaps being a missionary was more than just getting in the door at 9:30.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a lot of great opportunities to be zone leader, and I eventually got to be an assistant to the president so that I got to translate a lot and things like that.
Hmm.
I had a great mission. Really, I still cherish it a great deal. Came home. Didn't know what I was due. Like I said, I didn't go to school before I went on my mission. Worked at the distribution center instead. And like I said before, I sort of thought life ended. The mission experience was like the culmination of life. But anyway, I came home and enrolled at BYU purely for economic reasons.
I'm assuming Provo.
Yeah, Provo. Mm-hmm. I got a scholarship there, and that was for me, that was a done deal. I loved BYU, always thought I wanted to go there anyways. I got married in August of 2002 after I was home from my mission for about 8 months. The girl, my wife is, I knew her in high school. She was actually one of those small circle of friends who got called to seminary council. We didn't have a lot of get to know you time because we were friends in high school. Enrolled at, when, like I said, went to BYU. Eventually we moved down to Provo. I pursued engineering, computer engineering at BYU, and had a good experience with that. I mentioned at the beginning of this sort of the unleashing or freeing of this, of the analyst in me. And I think this is where this started to happen. In 2005, I finished my BS and started an MS in electrical engineering. And I found out, surprisingly, that I actually could think for myself and figure out problems on my own. And this started for me academically. I didn't need to didn't need to talk about, or I didn't need to take my professor's word for various issues. I could actually affirm for myself what they were saying was, whether it was true or not. And I started doing research, as graduate students in engineering tend to do, and that was very motivating and very satisfying for me. But I didn't lend that same sort of problem solving and analysis skills to the church or to relationship with my mom or anything else. It was at that point pretty limited to my career choice. In 2007, I took a job at a national laboratory in Livermore, California. That was in 2007, I think I said. Things were going really well for me there. We had two kids at that point. And then Prop 8 reared its ugly head. I always knew that I didn't fit in with either Republicans or Democrats, and I started pursuing politics a little bit, and I started looking at yes on Prop 8 and no on Prop 8 campaigns. I felt like both of them were spreading sort of half-truths, and I didn't feel like either of them were very good, I guess. And obviously at that point, we were being encouraged to donate and time and money to the Yes on Prop 8 campaign, and I was having increasing anxiety with this. But I sort of relied on a strong testimony of God's prophet and to get me through that period of time. I also, during that time, was involved in a political forum, and that political forum challenged a lot of ideas that I had in my worldview, not just politically, but religiously, spiritually, emotionally. And I found that I didn't feel like I had good answers, despite having felt like I'd received spiritual witnesses lots of times to various questions and about the church's truthfulness and things like that. And I think the important realization for me, and one that is, I think, shapes a lot of the things that I've dealt with in life, including the relationship with my mom, is that it might be me that doesn't have it quite right. In other words, at some point I realized that I might have it all wrong, that it might not be everyone else that's wrong, but I might be the one. And
to include your Mormonism, as far as, like, did it go that far? Or
Yeah, it went that far. You know, I realized I might not belong to the true church. I might not have all my beliefs quite right about that thing. So that really opened up the can for me of investigating things and learning and growing. So I investigated a lot of church history, which, as I mentioned, I thought I knew, because I'd read a lot of books, done a lot of research, and took it very seriously as a teenager. But I learned that I didn't know as much as I thought I did. And I found that I didn't have that there weren't a lot of satisfying answers out there, and I found that I was pretty unsatisfied. I felt like as a scientist engineer, I felt a bit disappointed by when I read apologist works, and I felt even more unsatisfied when I read anti-Mormon literature. But by that point I'd started to feel betrayed by the church, is the best word I can describe. I think this is what a lot of people who go through this end up feeling like, sort of anger, at the church. Why have they lied to me all these years? And things like that. I couldn't understand why, despite my diligence that, and despite having read so many books, that I wasn't aware of so many of the things and had not considered them. At that point, that was a real rocky time for me in life in general, as I think has been explored many times on Mormon Stories. But I found at some point I was pretty ready to leave church. Had investigated how to write the letter, all kinds of stuff, how to make a clean getaway, as it were. And at that point, I found Stay LDS, which John DeLynn helped or founded and started up. And for me, the admins there, Ray, Brian, Hawk Girl, were really influential in my life. They was the first place that I felt like people were willing to openly acknowledge issues and talk about them without telling me to shape up. I had seen a bishop about this, about some of my concerns, and this is in more or less words told that I should, that I needed to, you know, vote. I needed to go with Prop 8 and stay, you know, true to the faith and shape up type of a thing and not let those kinds of things get me down and things like that.
Not too dissimilar from maybe some of the same messages your mom got about dealing with her depression and...
Yeah.
Things.
Yeah.
Just shape up.
Yep.
And interestingly, we started talking a lot more at that time.
Yeah, yeah. This is really when things started. So to backtrack just a hair, I've mentioned a little bit about what it was like growing up, and hold on just a second here. It very much was that way. I very much had that attitude, like I said. You know, why couldn't my mom just choose to be better? I couldn't understand how, you know, all she needed to do was have enough faith. All she needed to do was pray. All she needed to do was choose to see the world differently, and that somehow this was going to get better. And and as I, like I said earlier, the mission experience was the beginning of planting the seeds to root out that opinion and that ideology. And when I got home from my mission, I think a lot of what happened was that I was able to see compassion, or have compassion for my mom, see what the kinds of things that she was dealing with, and internalize them. It also, I think, helped. We've talked a little bit about genetics and personality and environment and how those things combine to take one into depression sometimes. And I think I have the genetics, and I think I have the personality for it. And I think I'm fortunate enough that my environment has been good enough for me that I haven't had serious problems, because I do think that I'm prone to it. And
meaning that you haven't had a full-fledged depressive episode, but that you may feel...
Right.
Like low mood sometimes, or
yes,
have bouts where you're, yes, not quite sure why you're feeling low.
Certainly I've been depressed before. Mm-hmm. Not chronically depressed, but nonetheless depressed. And at some point I was able to take that feeling and say to myself, now imagine that was, you know, several orders of magnitude more intense. Oh, that must be what my mom feels like. Oh my gosh, I can't imagine how that must be. And all of a sudden, you know, the implications for all of that just manifested themselves. And it was like, oh, geez. So that must be how she was feeling and how she must have had to deal with so many of these issues. And, oh, it's amazing she's made it this far. And just a complete shift. And I'm not saying this happened, you know, immediately, but this was sort of the process in the I would say 3 or 4 years after my mission. And there was a point I wanted to mention. Some of the things that helped me make that turn, one of the very first thoughts that I had that helped me make that turn was an analogy, and I'll share that analogy with some caveats. But I had this analogy in my head that, you know, imagine that there was this person bound to a wheelchair for whatever reason, and this person wheeled themselves up to a building, and I look at the person and I see that they can't open the door, and I open the door, walk through, and let the door close behind me. And it occurred to me that this might be how I was treating my mom. That I was, you know, to those of us on the outside, looking at the person who thinks they're anorexic, it doesn't make sense. And it's hard to wrap your mind around why this person would possibly think that they are fat when they're not. And once I started applying this analogy, it started to become clear to me, you know, it's not fair for me to, just like I wouldn't expect a person in a wheelchair to open the door and go through themselves, I would try to open the door for them and help out. Likewise, it might not be fair for me to expect my mom to see that she's not fat like I see that. It just wasn't a reasonable expectation.
No, I love that. And yeah. I think it's very important to draw parallels to things that we do understand more, which is more like physical health. You know, we talk about mental health, but physical health we get, you know, if there's a broken bone, it's pretty easy to see. I use the analogy a lot of times of a track runner on a high school team who's broken his leg. Well, we expect maybe for that person to still go to the meets or to support, you know, his fellow teammates. There's still things that person can do to, you know, go to physical therapy or things like that. But we would never say, well, buck up, get out there, do the race.
Yeah. Right.
You know, but yet with depression, we do expect people to be able to do what we're able to do.
Yeah. And the unfortunate part is that it's masked with, you know, with the physical ailment. You can see the person in the wheelchair. You can see the broken leg. And unfortunately, a lot of people, you know, my mom, for example, in public situations is excellent at not letting on that she has any problem at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you know? And so that was sort of the first main turnaround I had in shift in thinking that started this. But going back to where I was in my sort of bio that is not so brief anymore, I decided at some point after finding Stay LDS, and I listened to a lot of Mormon Stories podcasts, and got involved with Mormon Matters, blogging for them, and I decided that it was important for me to stay with my, what I considered, like has been often said, with my tribe, my people. So I decided to reinvent a lot of the beliefs I had, a lot of the worldview I had. In fact, I really broke down my worldview completely, and accepted at some point there might not be a God at all. Hmm. And the whole story of Christ in the New Testament might be a big fabrication. I accepted all these things as possibilities and rebuilt a worldview from scratch. And for me, I found enough things as I during this time, I was fortunate enough to heed good advice from people that, so I kept with expectations that were had of me at the time to obey the word of wisdom and stay moral and things like that. So I remained temple recommend worthy and decided to stay that way. And so that's been my drive ever since, I guess. So
what was useful about that as far as keeping kind of the more basic commandments? Did that help you kind of just really focus on the spiritual aspect of your kind of worldview? Or because I know that there's people that go through this crisis of faith that kind of go one of both ways. One is, yeah, I want to just kind of, like you're describing, just keep all the basic rules while I, you know, decide what I'm going to do in my mind. But then there's others who will be like, well, you know, now I feel kind of liberated. I can have a drink of wine, or I can, you know, I don't know, do some of these things that maybe before I felt so guilty about. What were the pros for you as far as staying?
Yeah. So I guess in the interest of being honest, I should say that I experimented like once with alcohol. I felt this need to prove to myself that I wouldn't be struck down from a lightning bolt from God if I, you know, had a beer. So right. so when I say I remain temple worthy, I guess in my mind I don't consider this one tryout to sort of nullify my entire recommend. It was one time, and I kept it ever since and before, and so I felt. To answer the question, I guess I'm always one to never want to live in regret, and so I simply heeded what I thought was good counsel, and it wasn't any more. It's not any more complicated than that. Someone told me, probably Ray or someone, that I ought to, you know, stay the course until I figure things out. And I said, okay, you're older than me, and perhaps have been down this road, and I'm going to heed counsel that is beyond my own. Which I think is important to point out as a theme throughout my life. I've been someone who was stalwart and did the things I was supposed to do, and it's served me pretty well over the course of my life, in taking things slow and heeding counsel of those in a position of more experience relative to my own.
Yeah, that's great. Were you able to include your wife in these types of discussions and like let her know what you were thinking and feeling and finding out, or was she not part of this process?
It was mostly a personal process, but she was aware of it, and we didn't have a lot of discussions, but particularly when I didn't get a hold of good advice quick enough. And, you know, if I'd have found Stay LDS first, I perhaps could have saved myself a lot of grief. But because I didn't find it till later, you know, I did learn, or I did say a lot of things to my wife when I was in my most angry phases. And that did not serve me well. And my wife, not to speak for her, but she has her own understandings of the gospel and has her own views. And she had been exposed to many of the things that I had just been learning and had already come to terms with those. Mm. So she wasn't surprised, shocked,
betrayed, feeling all that betrayal that you mentioned, yes.
Mm-hmm. Right. So most of it was me, her having to put up with some ranting.
Right.
That didn't go on for that long. I went through this process fairly quickly. You know, it's been 3 years since then, and I've been in a position of, you know, participating happily, albeit perhaps unsure about a lot of things, for 2 years at least. So, yeah. So,
okay.
That's good background.
Yeah. So, can we go back to your adolescent self and have you describe a little bit of what it's like to be in a family where there's severe mental health illness going on and being a child in that environment? It sounds like it was a pretty positive environment as far as you had loving parents who loved you and cared for you, but there was still a lot of, it sounds like, ambiguity and unknowns and kind of your mom not being around as much as I'm sure you would have liked.
Yeah, and I'll say a little bit more about that towards the end of this little segment here. But I think as I tried to think about what I might say about this, it occurred to me that it's just plain hard to describe because mm-hmm. it was when I was young. I didn't have the tools I have now to describe and to think about things. When I was quite young still, I think maybe eight through 12, I think I was too young to make sense of much of it. I thought my mom was just sick. Like I just remember thinking she was sick. You know, she had breast cancer. I did know that. I was aware of that. And I think maybe I thought that her hospital stays at Wynn, as she mentioned, and the university hospital were nothing more than an extension of physical ailments. I don't know that I really pieced together that this was something else. Like she mentioned, she's had plenty of physical illnesses as well, various surgeries, elbows, knees, things like that. And I think I just lumped these other problems in with those when I was still, you know, preteen years. Like my mom said, she was in the hospital quite a number of times, usually for at least a couple weeks, sometimes up to 2 months or a little more. I think my dad perhaps did a lot to shelter me and my brother from the realities of what was happening. I remember at some point I remember and noticed that my mom wasn't really making me breakfast anymore, and in some cases dinner too. I remember her spending large amounts of time in her room with her door shut, and I remember not knowing how to deal with this situation. I think I just shrugged. I don't think I knew what to think or what to do. So I would say, you know, preteen years, the best description I have is that I just didn't know what was going on and thought that this was a physical sickness or some kind that my mom just had. And I was just unfortunate enough to have a mom that had these kind of problems. But I didn't understand more than that. As I became a teenager, we, and particularly in high school, a lot of the realities started sinking in. We had, I think, typical teenage parent drama in a lot of ways, and various arguments, and I think they were complicated a bit by the knowledge that my mom wasn't really well. And so I often turned to, like I mentioned before, this friend. And I don't think he or I really had any idea what we were talking about, but he had a way of saying things in a way that made sense to me and that was satisfying for me. And so a lot of my ideas, a lot of the things that I thought, I think were things that he and I came up with as we talked and counseled with each other. I remember lots of times as a teenager sitting in a parked car in my driveway for several hours talking with this friend. Hmm. And sharing a lot of these issues, not just related to my mom, all kinds of issues, but definitely ones related to my mom. You know, oh, my mom's in the hospital again, and a lot of times it was, oh, well, you know, she must be doing this to get attention, and if she just prayed and had faith, and she just could choose to, and she's being the victim again. And my mom said something earlier about how she's always liked to be involved in her kids' lives by, you know, being in PTA, being in joining the group of parents that helped with football or with whatever it was, and I resented that a lot in my teen years. To me, this was my mom stealing my thunder. This was my mom turning the attention, which should have been on me, onto her, and it was an attention grab. And when it wasn't an attention grab, it was her playing the victim, and thus getting the attention anyways. So I think that was how I framed it in large measure as I went through my teenage years. Go ahead.
Well, it sounds like there was some hurt there, which maybe then developed into maybe some anger or resentment, which then, you know, we can get into kind of those blaming stances. I mean, would you say that you knew that you were angry at your mom, or would you say that now?
I would say before that, I turned to apathy. Mm-hmm. So maybe perhaps confusion to apathy and then to resentment. And I won't say just anger. I resented my mom in high school very much. Yeah, this is not news to her.
Because you were supposed to be having all these moments, you know, your high school moments, this is the time of your life kind of a thing, and here your mom is ruining that for you.
Yeah, it was interrupted by her victimhood, her attention grabbing, and her, you know, having whatever problem she was having. I mean, at some point for me, her going to the hospital resulted in a reaction of a shoulder shrug from me. Oh, here we go again. You know, what this time? How long is it going to be for this time?
Right.
And at some point for me, the coping mechanism became apathy. And then that turned to resentment later on.
Right.
There are a few things that really stand out in my mind that I think are worth sharing. I remember one time I came home from school and I found mom out in the car in the garage, passed out. She'd done carbon monoxide type thing
in a
car with a vacuum hose attached to the exhaust pipe and into the window of the car. And I drug her into the house and called my dad and rushed home, I think, and called her to the hospital. I don't know if that was one of the times that an ambulance came, but I don't think so. I think my dad rushed home and took her to the hospital. But I remember that vividly.
How old were you when that happened?
You know, I don't know. I think junior high, but I'm not positive.
So not very old then, like 12 or 13, or
not very old. No, and I don't, and I don't even remember what my brother, if he was there or what he thought. I don't even remember that bit. I remember coming home, finding her, dragging her in the house, and calling my dad in a panic. This was sort of, I think, right before I flipped into an apathetic view of it as a coping mechanism.
Right.
I remember several times finding her shortly after cutting herself. And I think at that point I was probably the most ambivalent about it. Like I said, just apathetic. I just shrugged. Oh, mom's cut herself again. Probably need to go get some stitches. I wonder how many this time. And off I go to do my own thing. Go down in the basement to read my scriptures or whatever it was.
Right. Well, and you keep saying coping mechanisms, so I'm hoping and I'm assuming that you understand that these were actually somewhat healthy and protective measures that you were taking.
Yeah. In retrospect, it was a survival technique. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I could have done it any other way, given the circumstances, except for had I been more willing to go to a counselor, perhaps I could have developed coping tools. But, you know, that was what I had to work with, and that's what I came up with. And aside from, you know, it hurt my relationship with my mom, but it allowed me to survive emotionally and not just survive, but I think some important things came from this for me personally. One of the most important ones is that, like my mom said, I've always been able to let out my emotions and what I was thinking. I kind of tend to wear my emotions on my sleeve a bit. And that was the way it was with my friend. I just would tell him everything. And that was the therapy for me. That's always been therapy for me, is to talk about whatever I was thinking or feeling.
Verbalize your angst.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it has nothing to do with whether or not the person could respond intelligibly or not, though I think that maybe helped with my friend. It had more to do with me just ranting mm-hmm. for a bit. And when after I ranted, I felt better. And that's been a theme throughout my life, is I rant to people, various people, about my problems. And it's therapy for me.
Right.
So I think that was one important thing that came from this. One other example I wanted to bring up, perhaps because it's the most interesting. I remember one time... she mentioned that she was diagnosed with DID, dissociative identity.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one time in particular, she picked me up from a bus stop. And as we were walking away from the bus towards the car, I looked over all of a sudden, and it was clear to me that something had changed. And my mom went from being what I knew to be my mom, to a scared little girl. And scared little girl was I had to drive home because the little girl couldn't drive. And so I drove home. I mean, this was clearly after I think this was after my mission even. I don't remember that for sure. Obviously, I could drive. But she stayed in this persona for an hour or so. I remember coming home from her picking me up from the bus stop, and she went in and sat on the couch. And, you know, about an hour later, just as suddenly as it seemed to have come, it was like it was over. And I remember she asked me about, you know, what was happening, and I described to her that it appeared that one of the other personalities, as it were, came, and the scared little girl came, that was a little bit scary for me.
Is that the only time that you had seen something like that?
No, that's just the one that I remember vividly seeing both ends of the transformation. I could see, I knew there were other times, and I had experienced other times, but I usually only got to see one end of the transformation. But that one, I saw them both, and I saw the quick transformation which was...
Can you explain a little bit about what dissociative identity disorder is to maybe those who wouldn't know, or would you prefer me to do that, or tell me what you know.
Well, I have it in my mind lumped up a little bit with, I think for her anyway, for my mom, it was lumped in with what at the time was the multiple personality issue. And when you dissociate, you sort of go to whatever place you go, and you know, out comes the other something else. You dissociate from reality, in a sense. That's the poor man's engineering explanation. So give it a whirl.
Yeah, Josh, no, I think that's about right. I think, I mean, they really aren't really using multiple personality disorder as a name anymore. Well, there's some controversy about that, I guess.
Yes,
is what I'll say.
I know.
Yes. But I think that the way you've couched it is very good, that there is a dissociation, and that can happen in many different ways. There's plenty of people who have been diagnosed with dissociation who wouldn't qualify for multiple personality. Mm-hmm. And you can see this many times with, for instance, either sexual abuse victims or people who are being raped. It's almost like they can describe themselves watching themselves lift from their body, and they can almost watch the experience from above or from somewhere else, so that they don't have to be in. So again, it's a coping mechanism.
And interestingly, my mom and I actually have talked about that controversy, because one thing that I failed to mention was when I was going through my process of having a faith crisis, I did a lot of research into psychology. I read several books and listened to several online psychology classes from various universities and things, and tried to learn about it. And I remember learning about the controversy that DID had and the multiple personality had. And I remember discussing that with my mom. And we've often wondered, you know, if it was the diagnosis that caused the symptoms, or the symptoms that caused the diagnosis, or, you know, it's not very clear, because despite the fact that I know of and can identify various instances where it happened, you know, neither of us are particularly convinced. But I will say that she, there was a time when the multiple personality thing was on the table as a diagnosis. You know, we could label them. Mm. You know, they had colors associated with them. They had ages, and I got to a point where I could identify who came. Hmm. You know, which one was this? Was this the person who was the public persona that had that? You know, that identity had its own name. Was this the scared little girl? Was this the, you know, which one? And I had learned to identify those. Now, as time has progressed, you know, whether she's gotten better with these things, or, you know, because the diagnosis isn't there, she just doesn't have them anymore. I don't know, but she doesn't seem to, I don't notice these things anymore. And I just see my mom now.
Mm-hmm. Is there something that you could maybe just give us your input for about a few minutes, as far as this particular diagnosis is concerned?
Yeah, there is. I fought that diagnosis like hell with everything in me. Did not want it, was not going to have it. And yet I knew clearly that, and I think there needs to be a separation made, a distinction made here between dissociative and dissociative identity disorder. Mm-hmm. Because I knew clearly that I dissociated. I could be driving home and not even know where I was. I had gone somewhere, and so we worked out a plan, my psychiatrist and I, that I would drive the same route home every time so that I could remember how to get there. Because I do know that there was so much pain, and even before then, I had a tendency, when things got rough, when I was young, I would just mentally check out. I would mentally go to some other place.
Right.
So DID, not DID, I don't care. But I do know that I was dissociative.
Right. And then as to these personalities that, you know, your son says he can remember knowing certain ones that would kind of take over. Is that something that you remember much about, or?
Yeah. Yeah, I worked with an art therapist up at Wynn who I learned so much from. And he was a great, great source of information, and he knew me so well. He would bring projects to do art therapy, and then he would just bring a bunch of stuff for me, and he'd say, I know Sally knows what she needs to work on. And then we would talk about it afterwards. And I have them. It's like you said, they weren't, I saw colors. What I saw were colors. And I knew what color was with me. And I knew what that color did. Now, I know there's a lot of, there was with MPD, multiple personality, and it flies the same with DID, whether we accept it or whether we don't. Mm-hmm. But I think it was a way, knowing I dissociated, if green came to help, if I saw green, then I knew somewhere that I was getting a certain kind of help that I needed. And so whether that was just part of the dissociative piece that I was using, but yeah, there would be times when I would sit there and I'd actually, it would feel, I could feel a shift in me. I could feel a and I wouldn't always know who was there or what color or whatever. But I knew that the conscious me speaking to you piece was gone for whatever period of time, but there was still another conscious piece of me that was handling what had to be handled at the time. Right. So I don't know how the whole thing works, and it's not critical to me anymore, and I still do dissociate, mm-hmm. but not as easily and as readily as I used to. As things change and there's not as much of a need to have people there protecting me because I'm bigger now and I can do that for myself, I don't know.
But, yeah, well, I think that you're right in the sense of, I'm glad you separated dissociation from the DID, the actual disorder, because all of us dissociate. I mean, this is what we call daydreaming, right? Or, you know, all of us can kind of be driving down the road and all of a sudden, oh, we missed the exit that we were supposed to take, or, you know, because we kind of get our mind wandering into other areas. But yeah, I think that the dissociative identity disorder is seen more as the extreme case of dissociation, and it has been tied really, truly to people who tend to have a history of, you know, kind of the emotional and the sexual and physical abuse that we had talked about earlier, and not just a history of it, but a repetitive history of it, which again speaks to the chronic environment that you were living in. Both with the sexual abuse happening for a long period of time and also the physical abuse with your dad for pretty much all throughout your childhood and adolescence.
Right.
I will say that I haven't noticed, even though, you know, like you said, the dissociation is still there, like it is for all of us. I haven't noticed near the stark changes that were apparent at one time anymore. I said at the end of what I was saying before is that I just see my mom now, and we all have various shades of our sort of personality that take on different situations. You know, we act different in the public setting than we do in the intimate setting on some in some nuanced ways.
Right.
And I see that now with my mom, just like anyone else, but I don't see the wild, stark differences that I once saw.
Right. Well, and it sounds like you saw those kind of at the height of her
yes.
emotional crisis. And,
yes.
And she's come a long way since then. So, yeah, yes. So it would make sense that you're not seeing that as much. Because, yeah. like your mom just said, she doesn't need it. She's figured out other coping skills. Again, those are just coping skills. They're ways that we escape the current pain. They're ways that help us survive the moment.
Yeah.
Okay, so, yeah, so, Jay, sorry, I just wanted to kind of help people understand what we were talking about, but if you can go on from there, then. You had just given us the example about yeah. your mother and having to drive her home because she had switched into this different yeah. state.
The only other thing that I wanted to say was the attitude that I had in my adolescence came with me on my mission. I remember not being able to wait, just couldn't wait to get on my mission, not just because I had always wanted to go, but also because I couldn't wait to get away from home, the situation at home. Didn't want to deal with what I saw as the victimhood and the attention seeking. I just didn't want to deal with it anymore. So the mission was absolutely an escape for me. And I remember for the first several months on my mission, letters from my mom were painful for me to read. I didn't want to read them. And, you know, my mom is the only one who wrote me every week. And there were many weeks early in my mission where I just didn't want to read them at all. It was just painful. I just wanted to be away from it and done with it. And I think on some level, a lot of that was healing for me in that I needed space. I needed to be removed from the situation so that I could think about other things and not have the issues pushed down my throat constantly. I needed to be able to take on those issues on my own terms, in my own time. And the mission sort of afforded me that opportunity. And as I've mentioned, was really became the seeds for what eventually I consider to be a change of heart for me and the beginning of turning the relationship around. The only other thing I wanted to emphasize is perhaps how bad the relationship was. The relationship between mom and me prior to my mission was just not good at all. Despite that I was a good kid, obedient, didn't cause my parents grief in that way, but, you know, a lot of anger, a lot of resentment, a lot of hurt feelings. Thought I'd never be able to forgive her, thought I'd never be able to move on, was very much playing the role of victim myself in that way. So I only want to bring that up so that I can, so that it perhaps makes it more understandable why it took so long to turn the relationship around. I mean, it's been 8 or 9 years working on relationship and trying to heal before we're at a place where, you know, we can do this podcast, where we can understand each other well enough to do this kind of thing. It's been a lot of years of turning that around because the relationship was damaged. So,
Wanami, did you have this sense of feeling that your son was slipping away from you during that time? Were you with it enough to know that or be worried about that? Or how did you deal with this anger and resentment? Did you know how he was feeling about you?
Yeah, absolutely I did. After he graduated his senior year and he knew he would be going on his mission in December, he had wanted to drive up to Montana where my mom and dad lived, his grandma and grandpa. He felt like my dad would not be, his grandfather would not be alive when he came back.
which ended up being very prophetic.
And he had it worked out where he and his brother and my husband would go, and I was not allowed to go. And I wasn't buying into that one.
Yeah, I remember this pretty vividly.
Yeah, I'm like, wait a minute. Our car, our gas, you don't get to call the shots. And, you know, and yet I'm like, okay, you know, kind of don't want to be around you a lot either because you've made my life pretty miserable this last year. And so I'll just sleep in the back of the truck and leave you alone. And finally, something clicked in and I just went, you know what, Sal, it might be, you know what, self, it might be really good for you to have some alone time because it has been a long, tough year. It's been several long, tough years, but his senior year was particularly hard. And so they drove off and I stayed home, and I believe it was the right decision to make. And so, yes, I did know how very angry he was at me.
Yeah, I had shut her out of virtually everything over which I had any control. You know, trips, excursions, my spare time was spent with my dad. I didn't want to have anything to do with her. It was that level of resentment.
Right.
It just was. And also, I wanted to just mention that I didn't know. I was always sheltered from the way that my mom's dad was. I didn't know that person. The grandpa that I knew was a regular grandpa.
Right. He didn't have to parent you, right?
So no, he went out and shot hoops with me, basketball hoops. I mean, we played games, we teased, it was a very normal. I always thought he was a super guy. It always was a mystery to me why there was this tension with my mom. I learned later, you know, why that tension existed.
It was a safe relationship for you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Let me just ask you both really quick before you continue. Were there any efforts made by either mom or dad to sit the kids down and try to explain some of what was going on, or do you remember that, Jay? Or
please, can I address that one?
Yes. Jay,
you go first, Mom, and then I'll tell you what I remember.
Okay, because I wrote this down because it was. I'm glad you asked it. I wrote it down. It was a point I wanted to bring up when he was saying that he didn't remember dialogue about this when it was starting to get more and more intense with me, and it looked like the depression was going to not just by click of finger or a word of prayer go away. We sat both of the kids down and told them, I have a severe depression, and there is a biological component to it. And what we want you to know is that could be passed along to you. So if you are ever feeling depressed, and if you don't know what depressed is, this is what it is. These are the words. This is what you might feel like. And if it's just one day, maybe okay, something went wrong at school, whatever. But if it's starting to last and encroach in your life, come and talk to us, because there are doctors that we will get you to. We will get you to people that can help you at your age level and your understanding, so that you will have a better chance of dealing with it over your lifetime than I had. And we had that dialogue with him, and I know that my husband will support me with that because we felt very strongly.
You have a witness.
We felt very strongly that this was, I feel like we have always been very open with our kids and discussing things even that were painful. Okay. And I'll let you disagree in a minute, Jay, just a second. And with this one being as important as it was and being a generational thing, I did not feel like we could just blow over it and not address the issue.
Okay. Jay?
I don't remember it. I do not doubt that it was done.
It's called selective memory.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's fine. I'm sure it happened. I believe it. It's just, I just don't remember.
I'm assuming this happened during his teenage years at some point.
Undoubtedly.
Okay. Yeah,
was this a one-time talk kind of a thing, or were there continual, in your mind, Wanami, were there continual times that you guys kind of sat down as a family to address this, or?
We addressed it several times. The first time I remember doing it with him, he was in elementary school. Mm-hmm. And then later, like I mentioned, we did go to a family therapy, the four of us, and then they wanted to meet just with the boys, and we took them to there. So it was an ongoing, it wasn't every day in your face, da-da-da, but as it became apparent this was lasting a while, we would bring it up and have dialogue again. But, you know, when you're young and you don't know what's going on, they perhaps didn't even relate to, you know, these are all new words being thrown at them. And now he would research if I said something like that to him. Mm-hmm. In fact, I did the other day when I mentioned that I had had ECT, and he goes, "What? They still do that? I'm going to have to Google that and find out."
I did.
And is it?
Yes.
Yes.
Although there's lots of controversy about it.
Oh, yes. Well, I'm at the head of the controversy, let me tell you.
My first thought was like, I was thinking prisoners in Guantanamo or something. I'm like, surely they don't do this to people anymore. Come on. But I guess they do.
Can we discuss what this is? I don't think a lot
ECT.
Of people will know.
electroconvulsive therapy.
Yes.
They attach electrodes to you in various spots, and they shock you with electricity until you go unconscious and go into convulsions seizures and convulsions for approximately 15 seconds at a time, and then they, I guess, take you off the electrodes. And they do this over the course of, I guess, 12 different treatments. My understanding is it's not well understood how it works, except that it's thought to perhaps rearrange or create new synapses, new pathways for the mind. But there's problems with it in that there's lots of memory problems, particularly short-term memory. And I know that Mom suffered with the short-term memory which is why you eventually refused to do it anymore.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. I think you did a good job describing it. Go ahead.
With some people, it is very effective. Again, it's like when we were talking about treatments and medication. For some people, it is very effective, and they just come back every once in a while and have another tune-up, is what I've heard them call it, and then they're okay again for a while. And so for those that it works for, hallelujah, you know, it's one more thing. But there are those that it does not work for, or that cannot tolerate or will not tolerate the side effects.
Right. Yeah, and I do want to kind of state that it is something that's usually done when other treatments haven't worked, you know,
so
this is kind of like treatment resistant depression, or we've got, you know, schizophrenia or severe mania. We've got, you know, more severe issues that have, you know, medications have been tried, therapies have been tried, lots of different things have been tried, and yet the livelihood of these people are still at risk. You know, they're still at risk for suicide, or they're still, and so they'll try these types of treatments that, like you said, for some people work very well and for others not so much.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So yes, moving on from that.
I don't know what I was saying, if it was anything important. I don't know where we are.
Well, I think that, yeah, I think that we were just talking about, you know, how the parents tried at least to, you know, give some type of education or some type of knowledge to the children of what was going on. And it is always interesting to me, especially since I'm a family therapist and I work with lots of families or couples, that, you know, people within the same family will have very different recollections of the same thing that happened, you know, the same event. And so it is somewhat selective what we choose to remember and what sticks out in our mind later. And
absolutely.
So, yeah, so there's definitely, you know, I don't doubt that Wanami and her husband talked to you boys, and I don't doubt that for you that maybe did not mean much at all. So that's that's both of your experience in this.
Yep.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. Better far for us to strive our useless cares from us to drive, to the sand joy your hearts will swell. Oh, all is well, all is well. Should we die before our journey's through?